You are listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit us at lfla.org. In the spirit of reconciliation, the Los Angeles Public Library recognizes and acknowledges the First Peoples of this land. We pay our respect to their elders, past and present, and extend that respect to all Indigenous peoples today. For more information on which territory you may reside on, please visit nativeland.ca. I'm Jessica Strand, the Director of Public Programming at the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, and it's wonderful to see you all here for this terrific program this afternoon. Thank you so much for being here. I want to shout out to John Szabo, our wonderful city librarian, who is with us today. John, could you just stand up for a second? Thank you. I also want to thank all of our sponsors for making this important and special program possible. Aloud, our public programming series, is in full swing with a broad range of interesting and compelling programs, like our next Saturday program, which is also in the afternoon, entitled Baseball Reliquary, Shrine of the Eternals. Please check lfla.org or lfla.org-aloud for more details. For those not familiar with the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, we are a private nonprofit organization devoted to fundraising, advocacy, and innovative programming in support of the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you to the many Library Foundation members who are with us today. If you are not yet a member, I hope that you will consider joining the LFLA to continue enjoying programs like this one, and to support life-changing programs like Read Baby Read, Career Online High School, Adult Literacy, and Tech to Go, which give anyone with a library card the ability to take out a Chromebook and a hotspot. These programs and initiatives are for Angelenos of all ages and help so many children, teens, and adults improve their lives and achieve their dreams. If joining LFLA is not in your budget right now, then join the Los Angeles Public Library. It's free, and with 73 branches around Los Angeles, there's one in your neighborhood. Each branch provides a space to work, a space to think, a space to grow, and a space to learn without any conditions or questions. Everyone is welcome. And with a library card, you get an access to an abundance of online resources, like e and audiobooks, movies, and more. This afternoon, we are lucky enough to have two exceptional thinkers grace this stage: U.S. Surgeon General Dr. Vivek H. Murphy, and the renowned social scientist and consultant for four U.S. presidents, Robert D. Putnam. The two will discuss what they've learned through advocacy, research, writing, and public speaking about issues that are plaguing our nation, like loneliness and perhaps its remedy, community. Their work was paramount in influencing the Library Foundation's exhibit, Something in Common, which looks at clubs and societies and how shared interests create vibrant communities. As Marcus Aurelius so aptly put it, what's not good for the hive is no good for the bee. It's with great pride that I introduce my colleague, Todd LaRue. Todd is the Director of Special Projects for the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and a curator of the exhibition Something in Common, currently on display in the Getty Gallery at the Central Library here through November 6, on the second floor, so please go. Todd is hard at work on his book, Specific Museums of Greater Los Angeles, which publishes in 2024. Todd is a great collector of the old, the odd, the interesting, and obscure. He is also most recently a joiner and fan of numerous clubs and societies in and around Los Angeles. Please welcome Todd LaRue. Thank you.
Thank you so very much, and thank you all for coming this afternoon. I've been looking forward to this conversation for a very long time, and we're really lucky to have these two distinguished guests joining us today, author and social scientist Robert Putnam and U.S. Surgeon General Dr. Vivek Murthy. Something in Common, the exhibition with which this program is associated, and which I hope you'll visit upstairs following if you've not already seen it, is a celebration of the things that bring us together with others and a recognition of our public libraries as a safe and welcoming gathering place that is open to all. Even before the pandemic upended our reality and continues to affect our lives today, I was going around the city visiting, joining in unique, unusual, and beautiful examples of community being built by groups like the Baseball Reliquary or the Los Angeles Breakfast Club, Feminist Center for Creative Work. And even while being so inspired by those experiences, I understood that we're living through a time more divided, more lonely, more unequal than any in living memory. I heard firsthand how countless community groups and organizations have struggled to survive and attract new members in recent decades. And when I would casually ask people what clubs or groups they belong to or affiliated with, the most common response by far was none. It was clear that the success stories of camaraderie, trust, acceptance, and reciprocity that the featured groups have fostered is very much the exception and not the rule in 21st century America. Despite the inherent gloom of this subject, which was exacerbated by and more widely acknowledged in light of the forced isolation imposed by the pandemic, it was heartening to know that there were individuals like Dr. Murthy and Dr. Putnam working at the highest levels, not only to diagnose these problems and warn of the real dangers they present, but who are also committed to working collaboratively on solutions and who have a unique perspective on what it might take to heal our democracy and ourselves. So, without further ado, I'd like to introduce our esteemed guests. Dr. Vivek H. Murthy was confirmed by the U.S. Senate in March 2021 to serve as the 21st Surgeon General of the United States. He previously served as 19th Surgeon General under President Obama. As the nation's doctor, the Surgeon General's mission is to help lay the foundation for a healthier country, relying on the best scientific information available to provide clear, consistent, and equitable guidance and resources for the public. As Vice Admiral of the U.S. Public Health Service Commissioned Corps, Dr. Murthy also commands a uniformed service of over 6,000 dedicated public health officers serving the most underserved and vulnerable populations. The first Surgeon General of Indian descent, Dr. Murthy was raised in Miami and is a graduate of Harvard University, the Yale School of Medicine, and the Yale School of Management. He recently launched a new podcast, House Calls with Dr. Vivek Murthy, which explores how conversations have the ability to help us heal. He's the author of Together, The Healing Power of Human Connection in a Sometimes Lonely World. He's a renowned physician, research scientist, entrepreneur, and mango aficionado. Robert D. Putnam has been described as the poet laureate of civil society. He's the Malkin Research Professor of Public Policy at Harvard University, a member of the National Academy of Sciences, a fellow of the British Academy, and past president of the American Political Science Association. In 2006, he received the Skitt Prize, the world's highest accolade for a political scientist, and in 2012, Barack Obama awarded him the National Humanities Medal, the nation's highest honor for contributions to the humanities. He's written 15 books, translated into 20 languages, including Making Democracy Work and Bowling Alone, both among the most cited and best-selling social science works in nearly a century. He has been consulted by Presidents Carter, Clinton, W. Bush, and Obama, as well as presidents and prime ministers from the UK, Ireland, and Finland to South Korea and Singapore. His most recent book, The Upswing, How America Came Together a Century Ago and How We Can Do It Again, is a widely praised study of broad 20th century American economic, social, political, and cultural trends. Please help me welcome to the stage Dr. Vivek Murthy and Robert Putnam. So thank you so much, both of you. Again, we're really honored to have you both on our stage for this important conversation that we've been thinking a lot about here at the library with this project, and which I think all Americans have been thinking about. So I think we wanted to start with Vivek, if you wouldn't mind sort of setting the stage for us and sharing some of what your experience has been with the state of community in America today with regards to loneliness and all the work you've done around that. And so if you wouldn't mind just giving us a kind of broad overview of your perspective on that.
Sure. Well, thank you, Todd. And how wonderful to be here in Los Angeles with all of you. And thank you for hosting this event. And it's a particular honor for me to be here with somebody I've admired for a long, long time and who I think of as a hero, and that's Bob Putnam, who's done so much on this issue, but to help our country understand about community. And I don't mean to embarrass you, Bob, but I will. that when I remember years ago reading Bowling Alone, Bob's seminal book, and you know, as a young person, it really fundamentally changed how I thought about medicine, which I was studying at the time, and how I thought about the challenges that we were taking on. In medical school, I learned so much about diseases and illness, but didn't think so much about community and what that meant for the patients I was serving. But that book was a really powerful influence in my own life, of course. And when I think about your question, like, what is the state of loneliness of connection in America, I think first and foremost about the conversations I've had with people around the country as I've traveled. And this is really one of the great privileges I have in this job, is being able to meet people in different parts of our nation and just to be able to listen and learn from them about what their lives are like. And what I was realizing, even during my first stint as Surgeon General, when I was traveling around in 2015, was that people were telling me how alone they felt in terms of all the burdens they had to carry in their life. They often felt like they had to do that by themselves. You know, young people would tell me how they would walk around college campuses with hundreds of other students, but that they felt invisible. People sort of would often talk about this notion that, or this sort of nagging feeling that nobody had their back, that somehow they were up against all of these major challenges and uncertainties and changing realities, whether it was technology or climate change or other things, but that they're kind of on their own. And as I dug more and more into that, I started to ask more proactively about what was behind that. I started to use the word lonely just to see, is that something that resonates with people or not? And it was fascinating because it was like the floodgates open. You know, all of a sudden, everyone had a story to tell about loneliness, perhaps theirs, perhaps the loneliness they saw in their family and friends, the loneliness they worried about in their children. And it became clear to me that this is not just a passing phenomenon. This was not just something that maybe I had observed in one town hall. This was happening all across America, in young people and older people. I was hearing it from men and women, from people in rural and urban areas. Then I started to dig into the data, you know, around this, and you start to find that loneliness is extraordinarily common. So depending on how you look at it, and there's a number of different types of surveys that have been used, different survey methodology, but even if you take some of the I would say more conservative, and I don't mean that politically, I mean that in terms of methodology, survey tools, you find that anywhere from around a third, you know, of people in America, all the way to the other end of closer to 55%, 60% of adults in America are saying that they're struggling with loneliness. What's particularly fascinating is how that breaks down by age, because people often think, oh yeah, the people who are lonelier, perhaps those who are elderly and living by themselves, maybe they've lost friends and family members. Those are not the people who are most lonely. But the loneliest people are, in fact, young people, right? Which is counterintuitive, despite their connection to technology, perhaps in some cases because of it. They are experiencing less and less fulfillment from their relationships than they want. And so this data was really sticking with me as I was thinking about this issue. And in survey after survey, it kept popping up that loneliness is a profound challenge. And just to put this in context, even if you take the lowest number in terms of prevalence of loneliness, based on the surveys that are out there, there are more adults struggling with loneliness right now than who have diabetes. I mean, and we think about how much effort we put into addressing an issue like diabetes. We'll talk a little bit about the health consequences, although I can mention that now, if it makes sense. But just briefly, we'll say that this is not just a common issue, but it's extraordinarily consequential for our personal health and for the health of society. It turns out people who struggle with loneliness have an increased risk of anxiety and depression, but they also have an increased risk of dementia, of cardiovascular disease, of premature death, of sleep disturbances, and the list goes on. When you look at the mortality impact of various sort of life conditions, if you will, the mortality associated with social disconnection is equivalent to the mortality associated with smoking 15 cigarettes a day, is greater than the mortality associated with obesity, right? And just, I think about this as someone who's served as Surgeon General, an office that has focused so much on tobacco over decades, an office that has also focused on obesity. And I think about how much public health muscle we put into addressing issues like smoking and obesity, yet how little we pay attention to issues like loneliness. And one last thing I'll say that I picked up on very early, when talking to people around the country, something that does not show up in surveys, but it's this pervasive sense of shame that people feel when they struggle with loneliness. To say you're lonely to many people is to say you're not likable or you're not lovable. People, it doesn't feel good to admit that, and it doesn't feel good to talk about that. So I even look at these numbers in the surveys and wonder if the number's actually a bit higher, because, again, people don't really want to talk about it. There's a sense of shame loneliness is sort of enshrouded in. But this is despite the fact that so many people struggle with it, despite the fact that loneliness in many ways is a normal biological signal that our body sends us, just like hunger or thirst, when we're lacking something we need for survival, in this case, human connection. And also, just like hunger or thirst, if that feeling persists, if it goes without being met, then it can damage us. In the case of thirst, it can lead to severe dehydration, kidney injury. In the case of hunger, it can lead to malnutrition. In the case of loneliness, it can lead to a bevy of physical and mental health consequences. So that is the state of loneliness in America right now. It stands as one of the great challenges that we have to first see and then address more clearly, because the impact on the individual is profound, and as Bob, I know, will touch on, the impact on society is profound as well, because when people are lonely, there's more and more data that shows that impacts your productivity in the workplace, it impacts how children perform in school, it affects our civic engagement in society, and it affects our dialogue with one another. I meet few people in the country who feel that the state of dialogue in America is healthy right now. But if you feel it is, please tell me, because I want to learn what you know. But we can't really fix dialogue unless we build relationship, right? Because relationship is the foundation for dialogue. So this is why this issue we're here to talk about today is not just a side issue, another issue in the long list of health concerns that we could or should talk about. To me, it's a foundational issue that impacts our ability to address many other challenges we're facing in society.
Yeah, I really appreciate you sort of painting that picture as dark as it may be. And I also appreciate you mentioning the fact and what many people have noted that this is not what we think of as a typical issue for the U.S. Surgeon General's office to be issuing notices and warnings regarding. And so that really speaks to the urgency of this topic and how important it is to sort of note the fact that you've, in recent years, found this to be within your scope as a medical doctor and as the nation's doctor. So it's incredible. In light of all that, we are fortunate to have Bob here, who's dedicated his career to studying the historical arc and circumstances that have put us in the moment we find ourselves today. And so he's prepared a brief slideshow, if we could put that up now, and is going to walk us through some of the broader historical context that informs everything Dr. Murthy Vivek just spoke to.
Well, thanks very much. It's a treat to be here. Especially it's a treat to be here in the presence of one of America's great public servants. Vivek and I actually know of one another's work quite well, but I'm not sure whether we've ever met personally face-to-face until just now. So here's the link, I think, between what I'm going to talk about and what he's just talked about. He's laid out very clearly, and I know the evidence, he's right, the dramatic effects of social isolation and loneliness on our lives and on our health and on the health of our whole society. I want to now zoom back from that close focus on this very urgent problem that he's laid out and take a wider and longer view to talk about what this context is within which these problems have emerged. And I'm going to do this by summarizing a little bit a book that I published with Shailene Romney Garrett a couple of years ago called The Upswing. And the book is filled with data, as most of my works are, and so I'm going to have to be really quick, but I want to give you, usually pictures are worth 1,000 words, so I'm going to give you a couple of pictures to show what's happened in America, if we have the next slide, what's happened in America over the last roughly 125 years. Beginning with today, America is in what my mom would have called a pickle. That is, we're in really tough shape as a country. And nobody in the world, nobody in America, nobody in this room is surprised about this, but we are right now in one of the most polarized periods, politically polarized periods in our national existence. It's rivaled only by the period between 1860 and 1865, so that's quite a measure. We're also, and independently of that, in a period of great economic inequality. Again, probably the gap between rich and poor in America has never been as large as it is today. And thirdly, we're in an era of great social isolation. This is the part that's most directly relevant to what Vivek was talking about. And finally, we're in a period of unusual cultural self-centeredness, if I can put it that way. And I'll say in a minute what I mean about that. So I'm going to show you some pictures of those, of trends over the last 125 years in those four dimensions of our society: politics, economics, society, and culture. Let's have the next slide. This is not an academic talk, so I'm not going to go through all the details about how every variable is measured, but they all have, all the graphs I'm going to describe have the same shape. The horizontal axis is time. So over here is America at the end of the 19th century, 1890, 1900, and over here is America today. And the vertical axis is a composite measure of this is where I would love to tell you more because I'm proud of the data analysis, but I won't. Vertical axis, in this case, means political comedy. Higher up means Americans were more likely to cooperate across party lines, both individual Americans and our political leadership. And so you can see, the basic curve you can see is that back here, America was very divided politically, both at the elite level and at the mass public level. But gradually, over the course of the first two-thirds of the 20th century, we became more and more able to cooperate across party lines. Cross-party collaboration became the norm in America. And then suddenly, in about 1970, that turned. And the last 50 years have seen steadily growing political polarization. You've all heard a whole lot about political polarization, and you might, if you read the public commentary, think, well, that must have happened just in the last 5 or 10 years. You can see it's mostly not the last 5 or 10 years. We've been going downhill on this measure. That is, we become increasingly polarized between political parties for the last 50 years. Let's have the next slide. I'm going to turn here quickly to economic inequality. I told you that we're also very economically unequal now. But if you go back to the period of the late 19th century, this is the period of just in the throes, just after the Great Industrial Revolution, and the gap between rich and poor, between the rich on the Upper East Side and the poor on the Lower East Side, was very great then. But then, as you see, coming forward, beginning in the 19-teens, and then there's a dip during the 1920s when, the Great Wall Street Bubble of the 1920s meant that there was increasing inequality, but then coming out of the 1930, coming out of after 1929, and coming out of that period, every year America got more equal. The gap between rich and poor narrowed every year. And at the peak in the 1960s, which you see there, this is hard to believe, the distribution of income and of wealth and of opportunity in America was more equal than in any country in the world. We were more equal than Sweden was in the 1960s. So I'm trying to make, we were very equal. But then, again, suddenly, as we get to the 1970s, the worm turns and we start becoming less and less equal. Steadily down, 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 down. This data ended in 2015, and it looked like, well, maybe we're going to finally bottom out from this trend toward ever-increasing inequality. But if we do have the data, that number is now down here. And it is true today that America has never been as unequal economically as we are, not even in the Gilded Age were we as unequal as we are now. Let's have the next slide. The next slide is what I sometimes call social capital. It just means, are we connected with one another? And this is directly related to what Vivek was talking about. And again, there are many measures behind this curve, like many measures. How close are we to our family? What's the strength of the family unit? What's the strength of our community life? Do we belong to organizations? Do we trust one another? All of those things, or are we socially isolated? And as you can see, back in the 1890s, we were coming out of the mass movement of Americans from villages to cities. When people moved from the village, whether the village was in Italy or the village was in Iowa, they left behind the older ways of connecting. Barn raisings and quilting bees didn't cut it on the Lower East Side of New York. And people were disconnected, very disconnected in that period. But then again, once again, as the century went on, you see, every year we got a little more connected. Through the 30s and through the 40s and in the 50s and into the 60s, year after year, more people were joining the Elks Club or joining the PTA or more people were trusting one another.
I did join the Elks Club, by the way, preparing for this project, just so you know.
Good. Well, then he's a dot way up there at the top, but the rest of us are down here. And there's a great exhibition here at this library of the organizations that are still in existence, many of them a little moth-eaten, but still in existence in L.A. And it's very, before you leave the building or later on come back and see the exhibition, here, it is a public exhibition, right? Just, not just for us.
Absolutely. We're open until 5 today, 7 days a week, but it closes next Saturday, the 6th, so today's
okay,
a good
so You see this curve. What this curve shows is once upon a time, Americans were very disconnected. We didn't know our neighbors. We didn't trust our neighbors. We weren't connected to our communities. We weren't even connected to our families. And then for 60 or 70 years, every year things got better and better. Trust went up. Connection went up, and all the things that go with trust and connection that to which Vivek alluded earlier. But then, and it turns out that all this happens in the mid-60s, I first began to vote in 1964, so a plausible story here is that I personally have brought on this calamity of America as we've moved from, in this case, from a cohesive society, and again, if we continue this graph down, we can continue it down. We're now about as disconnected as Americans have ever been from one another. Now, the next slide, I think, is, I wish I had more time to talk about, and I don't, more time about the methodology that underlies this, but we've got, because I'm proud of this work, but, and maybe later we can have a chance to talk about this methodology, but the basic, just trust me for a moment. Now, trusting anybody is rare today, so I'm asking you, take the plunge, just believe me for the moment. This is a composite of measures of how, to what extent, Americans think of themselves as all in the same boat. We're all in this together. Or, alternatively, we think, no, we're not in the same boat, and I'm out for me. And you might think that doesn't vary much over time, but actually what we see in the data is enormous changes. Back here, in this period, Americans basically believed in what was called social Darwinism. Social Darwinism was a crazy crockpot, a crazy idea that if competition and dog-eat-dog was the way the natural world was set up, that's the way we ought to do it. And these people then, Americans leaders then, believed that giving money to the poor was a very bad idea because it would just encourage them to have more kids, and it would be bad for everybody, at least be bad for the people at the upper end of the spectrum. So it was very much it's hard to believe this. The concept was we should all be looking out only for number one. That began to change. How it began to change is an interesting question that I won't get focused on right now. But then you can see over the course of the 20th century, it's the same damn curve. Year by year, we began to focus more on what we had in common. And more began to focus on what we owed other people. This was a kind of a moral change. And it continued up until, yep, there it is, this again, the 1964 is a turning point. Somehow I also triggered the collapse of American moral beliefs. And for the last 50 years, you see a steady downward trend. Now, I've used, this morning, I woke up last night and I thought a way to show that these curves that I've just showed you apply specifically to loneliness. And so I'm going to show you now a graph that I constructed about 2 hours ago, but it's real hard data that show the salience of loneliness or being alone in America over this last 125 years. Can we have the next slide? Whoa, that was a little too fast.
I don't know what happened there. Can we get that back up?
I can make it up, but it's. I thought of...
Describe it, and then we'll get the graph back up.
Sure. This is a technique that is used at great length in the book to look at what are people reading and writing about in America. Quite appropriate for a library. Okay, so the horizontal axis is the same axis. It starts from 1900 here and goes to today. And the vertical axis is to what extent are, in the books that we read and that we write, are Americans focused culturally on loneliness? In this case, I use the word alone, the frequency of which with which the word alone appears in all the books published in America year by year. This is not just social science books, it's cookbooks and kids' literature and so on, mystery stories. And what this shows is, at the beginning of the 20th century, loneliness, I'm using here the measure of the frequency of the word alone, but I've also done the graph. I just couldn't get it up on the graph, couldn't get it done in time for this presentation. Loneliness, the word loneliness or lonely, has exactly the same pattern. At the beginning of the 20th century, American culture was very focused on loneliness. But then remember the long 70 years in which we were getting more and more, became more and more a we society and less an I society? Those same years, we stopped worrying so much about loneliness because it was less of a serious problem in our culture. But then just at the same time, around 1970, when those other curves switched direction, you remember that? And we began to become more unequal and more socially isolated and more politically polarized and more focused on me, 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 and not on us. That's exactly when this graph begins to turn. You can see it right here. And this is the section of American history, especially this section, the last 20 or 30 years, that the Surgeon General, has, in both in his professional public work and also in his own writing, focused our attention on. So that's the larger picture. Everything he says about the danger to us, and especially to our kids, remember that point he made, which is really true. This epidemic of loneliness is concentrated among our kids. Everything he said is true, and it's getting worse. And all I've tried to show you is that's true in over a longer time perspective, and it's true for not just for this social isolation thing, but for the sense of we in America. If we're going to fix these problems, now how to fix it is a tough question. And this next sentence is not going to, it poses the problem. We've got to figure out how to become, once again, a we. Not just for our own health, although also for that, but for the health of our society, for the health of our democracy. I'm counting on you to help us figure this out. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Bob. That's a really helpful overview of the work that you've dedicated your career to and written extensively about. So if anybody does doubt any of the details of this or want to look into the data, read his books because it's all there. Vivek, what's your reaction to this? Why is it important for your purposes to have this information?
Well, this information is so powerful because it helps add credence to what people are feeling. You know, sometimes we feel this, but then we dismiss it. Maybe it's just us. Maybe I just had a bad day. Maybe I'm just in a funk. But what many people are feeling in terms of loneliness, this data clearly shows that, one, they're not alone, but it also puts it in societal context, that it's also not just an individual's fault that they're feeling this way, that there are broader trends that have been driving, cultural shifts, you know, as Bob mentioned, the shift from an I to we, economic shifts, our shifts in, as we'll talk about some more today, in our likelihood of associating with groups and getting together with friends and family members. All of these changes have been happening over a number of years, and they're impacting us deeply. So I think understanding the broader context is extraordinarily helpful. I think one thing that sometimes people may take away also when they understand the enormity of the problem is that that means that there's really nothing an individual can do about it, that it's intractable, that you just have to wait for whatever magic forces out there to act to reverse this. But I actually think that we don't have the luxury of assuming that somebody else can address this. I think that this is one of those moments where we have to ask ourselves, what can we do in our own lives to strengthen a sense of connection to those around us? And the truth is that there is something that we can each do, right? Like when we reach out to people in our life, when we choose to go over to the neighbor's house, you know, who just moved in last week, to say hello and establish a relationship, when we choose to reach out to the parents of our kids' classmates, you know, in school, these are all moments where we foster connection, whether it's with new people, or whether it's sustaining connection or revitalizing connection with people we already know in our life. And that makes a difference, because one of the other interesting things that you see in some of the data is that when one person feels lonely, that actually has a ripple effect on the people around them. So at work, in the workplace, for example, if you have an individual who says that they're struggling with a lack of connection to anyone else, that impacts their mood, but it also impacts the mood of the people around them. The flip is also true, though, that when you feel deeply connected, that you have a ripple effect on others. And if you look at the work of folks like Nicholas Christakis and others, they show that our social networks are very interesting in that, like, you know, if you smoke, it's more likely that the people around you will smoke. If you, are struggling with obesity, more likely the people around you are struggling as well. But with connection and disconnection, it works both ways as well. So I mention this only to say that, and as big as this problem is, that not only are there actions that we can take in our lives to bridge that connection, but it turns out I do think that that is one of the most important things we have to do. This is not a problem that gets solved because Congress passes a law or because some regulation gets put in place. That alone won't solve it. It has to most powerfully be located in the cultural shifts we make and the shift in personal practices that we decide to engage in our lives.
Can I follow up on that just very briefly? Because I completely agree with that, and I want to tie it back. If you'll remember just a minute, the big upside-down U-curve that we talked about, many people who look at that graph focus on the peak in the 60s and wonder what happened there. But the book was written, and the title of the book is The Upswing, to focus on the first half of the graph, because if you think about that graph, it's that period back around 1900 that's most like ours. And they did something right. We were getting at the turn of the last century, America was, just like now, in a funk, becoming ever more unequal, ever more polarized politically, ever more self-centered, ever more socially isolated. We saw all those things. And then they turned it around. So the purpose of this book was to say, they must have done something that we can learn from. And I don't want to now go into all the lessons, but people sometimes ask me if I'm optimistic or pessimistic about the trends. And I don't quite know how to fix it now, but it seems to me really important to notice that once before America has been in a situation and we did fix it. So that gives me at least some hope to think, well, we can maybe learn from them. It's the story of our book is not a story of, you know, one damn thing after another. It's a story of a small group of people, and then they soon became a much larger group of people. They were called the progressives back in that era, who decided to take arms against what was happening. Sorry, arms is a bad metaphor. Who decided to fight back against this situation they were in. And by doing so collectively, they put us on that path that led us to this, not nirvana, but really pretty good place. And that's the lesson I take from this, exactly consistent with what you're saying, with what you've been saying. We can do this, or at least people like us have done it before.
Vivek, your office last week issued a new notice about mental health in the workplace, and one of the points to that multi-prong approach that you're recommending has to do with creating a sense of belonging. Why is that the responsibility of employers in your words? Is it about productivity and general health of those individuals, or is there something more to it?
Yeah, well, thanks for raising that. Yeah, last week we did issue a Surgeon General's framework on workplace mental health and well-being, in part as a response to the fact that so many people, 76% of people, in fact, are saying that their workplaces have had negative impacts on their mental health. And there are many people who work in toxic workplaces or, again, workplaces that either don't necessarily make them feel like they are valued or that don't give them adequate time to rest and recover, or don't allow them time off from work to be able to care for their kids or their families. So there are many struggles people have had with the workplace. But the reason, we laid out in that framework five key essentials that include protection from harm, connection and community, work-life harmony, creating opportunities for growth, and ensuring that people know that they matter and that their work matters. But the, perhaps for many people, the most surprising one was the connection and community. And the reason this is so important is, you know, as I was mentioning earlier, when you are connected to someone at work, the data very clearly shows that has a positive impact on your productivity and on your creativity in the workplace. But what's interesting is you might ask, well, again, why should workplaces be concerned about this? Well, one, because it's good to care about your workers, and we know that this impacts deeply how workers feel. And that's especially important to pay attention to now, because during the pandemic, we've seen a dramatic shift in how people work, right? With many people working remotely or in hybrid type of arrangements. There are a lot of benefits to those hybrid arrangements, and they create flexibility, save commute times, allow people to be there for family, for friends, for sick relatives. One of the potential costs that we have to manage, though, is the lack of face-to-face time that you have with work colleagues and what that does to your feeling of connection. So it's not to say people shouldn't work from remote at all. It just means that we have to now be more intentional about how we cultivate connection in our lives, and the workplace is a big part of that. But the other reason that the workplace should care about this is because ultimately it impacts your bottom line. We know that when workers are feeling more connected to one another, generally they feel more supported in an environment. They tend to want to stick around, which means retention rates are higher. And we know that one of the greatest costs for businesses is turnover. Their productivity and creativity is better as well. So the bottom line is, both for the sake of the workers and the sake of the organization, focusing on building connection and community in the workplace matters. I'll lastly say this. This is not, sometimes you can think about these sort of recommendations around mental health and you might think, gosh, this is probably going to take a lot of money, like in the workplace. Like, where are we going to get the resources? Is there tough times? We're dealing with inflation. All of these things may come to mind. But just recognize that many of the measures that we were talking about in the framework for workplace well-being, a lot of these don't take a lot of money. Like, when it comes to fostering connection in the workplace, this isn't about throwing expensive community, company parties and picnics. This is about creating opportunities, sometimes small opportunities, for people to come to know one another as more than just skill sets, but as human beings.
So cheap picnics.
Well, more so, I'll actually give you a concrete example of something that we do in our office. So we have an activity now, and we had a similar one last time when I was SG in our office, called Our Humans of OSG. OSG stands for the Office of the Surgeon General. But this is a simple activity we do once a week, where for 10 to 15 minutes, we'll have one person in our office interview the other. And it won't be about work. It'll just be about their life. It might be about what it was like, you know, when they were growing up as a child. Who did they look up to when they were a child? What were they inspired to do and go into, even if it's different from what they're doing now? What were their hobbies? What gives them great joy now? What gives them hope for the future? When was the last time they felt deeply connected to someone or to themselves? These are the questions we ask. And it leads to this extraordinary conversation where you get this beautiful window into someone's life. Sometimes we've been working for somebody for a year, and then we'll listen to their 10-minute interview and feel like we understand them so much more deeply and so much more fully than we did before. And so keep in mind, what we're doing once a week is 10 to 15 minutes, and it costs no money. But it has an incredibly powerful effect on helping people feel like they come to know each other and appreciate one another. When we used to do this last time when I was Surgeon General, I still remember so clearly what it was like after we implemented it. Because within weeks, you could see that, number one, not only did that meeting become everyone's favorite meeting of the week, but also people started to work together more closely. They started to go outside their lanes to help others when they saw another person struggling. People's level of conflict went down in the office. All of this is enabled by coming to see each other as human beings, coming to know one another. And that's part of what we're called to do right now. We can do this in neighborhoods. Mayor Tom Tate in Anaheim, California, when he started his High Neighbor program, it was was a simple program to try to get neighbors to knock on each other's doors just to get to know one another. It didn't cost any money, but it was incredibly powerful, not just for making people feel like they belonged in their neighborhood, but also for emergency preparedness. As he always used to say, when emergency happens, before the firefighters get there, before the police get there, who's there first? It's your neighbors. They're the ones who are around. So the bottom line is, this is part of what I think organizations can do to cultivate a healthier work environment. But these things often, we have to recognize, don't always take a lot of money. They often don't even take a lot of time, but they do take intentionality and a little bit of structure.
Thank you so much for sharing that. It's really important and amazing work that you're doing on behalf of the country. So we are very grateful for that. I speak for myself, at least. I'm grateful for that. Before we, and I wish we had much more time for this conversation, but we want to leave a little bit of time for questions from the audience. Before we do, Bob, when you and I spoke earlier, and what many of us are wondering and worried about, frankly, is what happens next. And I know that, you know, you were kind of talking about how the next upswing is not going to come from the top down, so to speak. So could you just really briefly speak to what I mean by that?
Sure.
Microphone.
Sorry. As part of this book, we look back, indeed this was the main point of the book, to look back to see what lessons we could learn from the people just like us who had to solve this problem 125 years ago. And I'll just say very quickly a couple of the lessons. One is they were all young. This was a group called the Progressives, not progressives in the loose sense that we use now to mean people on the left, but capital P Progressives. That's the name of the movement. It was a very diverse movement. But first of all, they were all very young. Many of us have seen a picture of Jane Addams, who was one of the progressives, and she's an old lady when she got the Nobel Prize in 1930 for her work in creating settlement houses. But she did that work for which she got the Nobel Prize when she was in her 20s and 30s. These were virtually all of the people at that point who solved the problem were not old people like me. Old people like me sometimes could see the problem because they'd been around for a long time, but it was young people who had new insights. So first of all, young people. Secondly, it was a bottom-up movement. It was not the politicians and the national leaders were like the, you know, famous French revolutionary, got in front of the parade and led it, but the parade was already headed there. He just got in front of it. And that was true then. These ideas, the really interesting, powerful ideas, for example, the creation of Here's a fact I bet you don't know. Did you know that the high school, public high school, was invented in America in 1910 in some small towns in the middle of America, in Iowa and Kansas? That until then, nobody in the world had the idea that every kid in town, just because they were a kid in town, should get 4 years of free secondary education. That idea was such a good idea that it went viral. This was in the days before the internet, went viral. And within 20 years, every place in America had a public high school. Think about that. Ordinary people in these little podunk communities, I come from the Midwest, so I can use the term podunk, little podunk communities, they were the ones who had some of the most important ideas, and those ideas then percolated up. So that's another part of it. Think locally. Don't think globally. And don't wait for, you know, some leader on horseback to come solve the problems. That's not the way it worked the last time. It was us meaning the young people of that time. So I think this can be, I don't think it's a guarantee. I have a friend, a rabbi, Jonathan Sacks, he's now sadly dead, who was chief rabbi of England. He makes a really interesting distinction in this point. I hope you find this helpful, and then I'll shut up here. He makes the distinction between hope and optimism. And he uses religious language, which is relevant. By the way, I should have said another thing that was true about that earlier period was it was the leading variable of this previous time was not economics, not public policy. It was a moral reawakening of America to their obligations to other people. So if we look back at that period, I think the key is going to be focused on what we owe to one another morally. And if we get that right, then the other stuff will follow. Rabbi Sacks makes this distinction between hope and optimism. Optimism, he says, is a passive virtue. It's you standing back and looking at the trends and saying, I think things are going up or down. Hope, he says, is an active virtue. Hope is saying, I could see how it could go in the right direction, and I'm going to work my damnedest. He didn't say damnedest. I'm going to work my hardest to make it move in that direction. I don't know if I'm optimistic or pessimistic. Frankly, there's a lot of reasons to be pessimistic now in the world we're in, if you read even, you know, this morning's headlines. But I am hopeful, especially I'm hopeful about younger people in America, because we can see some signs that they are moving in the right direction. The turnout in the 2020 election, and apparently the turnout this year among young people, is going to be higher than ever in American history, except 1912, which was the last time that young people pushed us in the right direction. And the Greta Thunbergs of the world are the ones who are leading the fight for against global warming. So I don't think we can just, any of us can just sort of stand by and say, it'll happen, just wait, it'll happen, there'll be a turning. I don't think that's true at all. I do think we have it within our power, and especially young Americans today, have it within their power to do what people just like them did 125 years ago.
Fantastic, thank you. We only have just a couple minutes for photos Q&A, if you don't mind. Sure. My colleague Tiffany is out in the audience with a microphone. Raise your hand and she will come to you. And we've got, oh, sorry, here we go.
I came of age in the 60s, and at that point it felt like there was the social revolution happening. I could go to a ride board and get a ride anywhere I wanted. I trusted everybody. I felt like the world was in the midst of a revolution, a social revolution. There was a sexual revolution. There was the women's movement. There was the civil rights movement. And at that time, I just really believed that I lived in community. There were love-ins, there were be-ins, and then there was Burning Man. And that continued that kind of way of thinking and living. And I think one of the things that's brought all this down is review culture and cell phones.
I didn't hear the
review culture, where you don't just trust people, but you have to look them up and see if they're okay. I mean, I used to hitchhike everywhere,
sure,
and I never distrusted the people who picked me
right
up. And then suddenly it was too dangerous to hitchhike.
Right. Since I'm of that very generation, I also grew up in the 50s. I know the experience you're talking about. And
but did you hitchhike?
I didn't hitchhike, but I have data that says it was right. Many Americans did hitchhike, and that stopped in the middle of the 60s. It's quite, for a lot of different reasons, way too complicated now to try to unpack what happened.
But if you go to Orcas Island, you still can. And you get picked up by amazing people.
I would love to do that. Maybe you can take me and my wife there for a ride. But all I'm trying to say is, I do data, and the data say that you are exactly right. That was the peak, remember? That was the peak of our sense of trusting other people and of our actually not just being trustworthy towards other people. But the second half of the 60s turned in an opposite direction.
Another question? Gentleman here in the front, blue shirt. Mic is coming.
It's pretty clear that we have a very, a lot of distrust right now. We just turn on the news, there's a lot of mass shootings, especially here in America. And the people doing those mass shootings tend to be young, isolated males. I mean, straight across the board. My question is this, because I've done a lot of traveling, mostly in Europe. The sense of community there in Europe is so much stronger. Even in the countries in Eastern Europe where I've been, which felt very isolating at times, the sense of community there, especially in Poland and Czech Republic, all over Europe, is so much stronger. And they don't have the problems with shootings, and they feel lonely, but they cope with it so much better than I think we do. That's what I've seen. Do you guys have any comments on that, or is there places in the world that we should be looking at in terms of how to deal with loneliness better?
Vivek, I'm curious your perspective on this. Is this loneliness, and the gun issue is probably uniquely American, but is the issue of loneliness uniquely American, in your opinion and experience?
Yeah, it's a great question. And what's fascinating is that, and this is what part of what gives me, I think, a reason to feel optimistic and to be hopeful, is that there are places in the world where you can look and you can find communities that are, in fact, very connected and that resemble what you, ma'am, were referencing in the 1960s, where there is a high degree of trust, there's a low amount level of disparity between individuals, and where people have a great sense of connection and social security, not social security in terms of money, but in terms of relationships. But the truth is, when you look at the data on loneliness globally, a lot of other countries are struggling actually with loneliness too, more and more. This seems to be not an American phenomenon, but more so a phenomenon in the modern era of modern living, right? And I do think that this is bigger than a purely isolated economic or sociologic phenomenon. I think Bob referenced something that I think is really important to underscore. I think this is a moral crisis that we're in as well. We come to value less and less what other people bring to our lives, and have focused more and more on ourselves, not just ourselves benefiting, but on the narrative that we, on our own, can control our destiny and can create companies, can build fortunes, can drive wealth and power, etc. But that is why, to respond to a moral crisis, you can't respond to a moral crisis with public policy alone, but you have to respond with your moral imagination and with moral action. And that requires examining what values we want to underscore the world that we rebuild. Now, what's really interesting, I think, is this is a place where we actually likely have a lot of overlap, right? Most people I talk to when I travel the country and talk to folks in town halls and small groups, they want a world where people are kind to one another. They want a world in which compassion matters. They want a world in which our engagements and interactions with one another are characterized and grounded in love in some way. They also want a world where we have a responsibility to one another, where we don't just leave people out in the cold when they're suffering, but we say, you know what, we're going to do something to support them because they matter, even though I'm doing okay. And the truth is, in our better moments, that's actually who we still are, right? Even though you may not read it in the headlines, even though you may not see it covered in the evening news, if you just for a moment, each of you in this room, if you think for a moment about one person in your life who gives you hope, my guess is that there's somebody. Maybe it's a neighbor who cared for you when you were in a jam, you know, and needed somebody to pick up your kids or to watch your dog. Maybe it was a friend who checked on you when you were having a really tough time. Maybe it was a parent who stopped by to help you with childcare when you were really struggling. Each of us likely has somebody we can think of in our life who has embodied the kind of values I'm talking about. I actually think that is who we are. The journey to build a more connected world, the journey to create a world that reflects the deeper values that we're talking about here, this is not a journey to transform ourselves into something we're not. This is an effort to return to who we intrinsically are. And a lot of stuff has happened in the last several decades that have moved us away fundamentally from who we are naturally inclined to be. And it's complicated. There's been a lot of change in technology. There's been a lot of change in how we receive information, what kind of information we receive. There have been other forces, at play in our lives, which have perhaps led to us moving further and further apart. But I do not think we should let anybody convince us that this goal of becoming a more connected society, of restitching together the social fabric of America, that this is somehow not achievable, or that it's a foreign goal, entity or foreign goal. This is fundamentally at the center, of who we are. And finally, just keep this in mind. We don't have 10, 20, 30 years to start deciding whether or not we work on this problem. Because each day, like when I travel the communities, I see the consequences of that disconnection. I see young people who are struggling with their mental health and who are turning to alcohol and to drugs to ease their pain, to give them some modicum of relief. I see older adults doing the same thing. I see people whose despair is growing because they feel like the world is spiraling down and down and there's nobody out there to look out for them, nobody who cares about anyone else other than themselves. People are losing faith in what we can be, in the fact, in the notion that we can actually be a united entity, that we can be a group that values humanity. But that faith can actually be powerfully restored with interactions with other people. When you choose to engage with somebody in a moment of kindness, when you pause to ask a coworker how they're doing, and then you actually listen to what they have to say, these are all moments where we are telling people, I see you, you have value, you matter. And that is a message that we need to send to people all across our country. It's a message that no law can send, no regulation can convey. But we, it turns out, have a power that's greater than any law, than any regulation. We have the power to rebuild human connection, to take those values of kindness, compassion, and love, and to bring them to life in an extraordinarily impactful way. And if we do that, not only will we help ourselves feel better and the people around us, but we will create a source of hope for a rising generation of young people who look around themselves and wonder, who has their back? Who's ensuring that the future is more secure for them? Let us lead by example in showing them that these values are achievable, they're livable, and that they are going to be the future, you know, for all of us together.
I think that's such a beautiful note to end on. Thank you.
Aloud is made possible by the Hearst Foundation, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, the Los Angeles County Department of Arts and Culture, Errant Fox, City National Bank, the Los Angeles Public Library, and additional generous supporters of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. To support programs like this, become a member at lfla.org.